Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Roots Survive, presented by Shelley Moore Guy and Dorian Bird, number 15467. Let's listen in.
Heart and soul, body and mind, but the very essence of our existence is spirit. What is it about the human spirit that produces the courage and the strength to beat insurmountable odds, to survive and endure despite unbelievable circumstances? Our spirit embodies the very essence of our existence. We believe that it has been handed down from generation to generation, beginning in Africa, the motherland, where for eons, we believe that the Creator heard us when we cried, saw us when we faltered, and helped us along the way. And now, more than ever, it is time for us to get back in touch with the spirit that lives inside us all. Because without it, we are less than whole. But with it, there is nothing we cannot overcome. For the essence of our existence is
and gave us creativity. For the sisters who died that we might live, and the sisters who lived for us to be born, who got up in the morning time, cried in the moaning time, who survived the morning time after the insulting, beating, raping, murdering of our mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, daughters, sons, ourselves. This is for the bodacious, broad sisters, the performing for more than applause sisters, for the shotgun toting, fighting for the right to vote, and voting sisters. This is for the first millionaire sisters, the dishwashing sisters, the ambassador sisters, stay-at-home mother sisters, engineering sisters, janitor sisters, doctor sisters, midwife sisters, lawyer sisters, defendant sisters, maid sisters, actresses acting the part of a maid sisters. For the women who knew that being female don't make you a woman. For the women who scream, "Ain't I a woman?" when the larger society thought them not. This is for the us who know that to become them, them type of sisters, we got to be here now. We got to be here for the now. We got to be her and what we gonna do now.
Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water, God's gonna trouble the water. water. Wade in the water. Wade in the water. Children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the waters. She lay skin down on the moist dirt. The canebrake rustling with the whispers of leaves, the loud longing of hounds and the ransacked hunters crackling the near branches. She muttered, lifting her head a nod toward freedom. I shall not be moved. She gathered her babies, their tears slick as oil on black faces, their young eyes canvassing mornings of madness. They said, Mama, Mama, is Master gonna sell you from us tomorrow? She said, yes, unless you keep walking more and talking less. Unless the keeper of our lives releases me from all commandments, yes. And your lives, never mind to live, will be executed upon the killing floor of innocence. Unless you match my heart in words, saying with me right now, say it, children, say, I shall not be moved. In Virginia tobacco fields, leaning into the curve on Steinway pianos, along Arkansas roads, in the red hills of Georgia, she cried against calamity. You have tried to destroy me, and though I perish daily, her universe was often summarized into one black body finally falling from the tree to her feet. It made her cry each time in a new voice. All of my past hastens defeat. Strangers have claimed the glory of my love. Inequity has bound me to his bed, yet I will not be moved. She heard the name. She heard those names, those swirling ribbons in the winds of history that called her nigger, mammy, property, creature, ape and baboon. They called my grandmother it. But she said, my description cannot fit you. You see, I have a certain way of being in this world, and I shall not be moved. No angel stretched protecting wings above the heads of her children, fluttering and urging the winds of reason into the confusion of their lives. They sprouted like young weeds, but she could not shield their growth from the grinding blades of ignorance or shape them into symbolic topiary. So she sent them away, underground, over land in coaches, and shoeless. And she said, when you learn, teach. When you get, give. And as for me, I shall not be moved. So she stood in mid-ocean, seeking dry land. She searched God's face. Assured, she placed her fire of service upon the altar. But when she appeared at the temple door, no sign welcomed black grandmother into here. So out into the crashing sound, into wickedness, she cried, no one nor no one million ones dare deny me God. She said, I go forth alone and stand as 10,000. The divine upon my right impels me to pull forever at the latch on freedom's gate. And the Holy Spirit on my left moves my feet without ceasing into the tents of the righteous and into the camps of the free. Oh, those mama faces. Mama faces, they're lemon yellow, plum purple, honey brown. twist and twisted down a pyramid of years. She is Sheba and Sojourner, Harriet and Zora, Mary Bethune and Angela. She is Annie to Zenobia, standing before the abortion clinics, confounded by the lack of choices and the welfare lines reduced to the pity of handouts. In the operating room, husbanding life, in choir lofts, holding God in her throat, on lonely street corners, hawking her body. And she's in the classrooms, loving those children to understanding. Centered on the world stage now, she sings to her loves and her beloveds, to her foes and detractors. However I am perceived or deceived, whatever my ignorances and conceits, lay aside your fears that I will be outdone, for I shall not be moved. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. God's gonna trouble the water. Our grandmothers.
Thank you. Thank you. The poem by Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. And I discovered it over 12 years ago. I had been invited to come and attend and perform at a Women in History program, which is, you know, in March, and at one of our local colleges. And I said, yes, I would. A friend of mine actually works at the college. And I said that I would. And as the date grew near, the time for me to attend and participate, I realized that I had attended and participated several women in history programs in the past, and there was hardly ever any mention of African or African American women, Black women. And I started to think about that, and maybe there was what I call the token mention of the Sojourner Truth and her Ain't I a Woman declaration, because that has been tied to women's liberation, and it was a good speech. But there was never any mention. There was always the mention of, you know, the Susan B. Anthony's, and I'm not taking anything away from any one of those women. But there was never any mention of my grandmother. My grandmother. All great, 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 whatever great of them were never, ever mentioned. And so I began to think about activists, you know, because this is what we're talking about when we're talking about women in history, Women in History Month. We're going back to those original folks. And I began to think about, who is an activist? What makes an activist? Who are the people who resist and defy? Who are they? And so I began to think about my grandmothers, those who came from Africa, those who began as perhaps a little girl in Africa, just doing what she is supposed to do as a little girl in Africa, playing or working or whatever it was that she might have been doing. And I thought about this little girl doing what a 10-year-old child might do. Secure. This little girl is, because she has a mother and she has a father and she has siblings and she has people in this village community who love her. Because that's what people do with children. And so one day her security is shattered and she is snatched, physically snatched away from home and family and put in a place along a path. So when she joins this path, she is joining several other people online. And when she gets to the line, she's chained by her ankles to someone else's ankle in front and in back. She's chained perhaps from the waist. And they're walking. They're told to walk. And she's walking along, 10 years old, wondering what in the world. And I'm thinking that at the moment she was snatched, long before she was chained, her spirit resisted. And in that second of resistance, one of my grandmothers became an activist. In that second of resistance. And just because she resisted, though, didn't mean that, you know, she won that fight. But she resisted. And when your spirit does resist, you are alive. And so she's made to walk online. And she's walking online, and can you imagine at 10 years old trying to figure out, where am I? And she looks around at people that she might remember from her village, women and men. And there, down there, she looks, and there are some of the village warriors. Surely, surely she won't be here long. These are some of the strongest people in the village. That is their job, to protect. And so for a short time, she feels secure again. Surely she won't be here long. And they walk, and they walk, and they walk, and one of the warriors resists. But he's killed. Unchained, removed from the line, and tossed aside. What does that do to the spirit of a 10-year-old? And they continue to walk. And they walk, 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 and I mean, it's a long, over time. Before she gazes up, and there is, along the river, what seems to be a mountain. And they walk toward this mountain, and it turns out that it is a ship. And she's herded in with the rest. And so begins her journey. And she crosses through the Middle Passage, and she arrives in the America, in America, to another strange place, and she's still 10, without anyone, without the protection of her mother and father, those that she has known. And she's put online again, and she's observed and inspected and stripped naked as a 10-year-old girl, and sold to the highest bidder, because a 10-year-old girl who was healthy, with healthy teeth and arms and legs, will fetch a good price. And so then again, she's shuttled off to another place where she learns to survive. Where she learns to survive. And so I began to think about, who is an activist? Who can be an activist? What qualifies us to be an activist? And so I decided that I should go and represent my grandmothers. And so I arrived at the appointed place and time, Black Hawk College. And one of my best girlfriends is there, and she and I pulled her to the side. I said, Kathy, now I do have a couple of poems, but I want to tell you that I'm going to be talking about this. And there might be some people who might not appreciate it, but this is what I have to do, because I have to represent my grandmothers. Who else but me? She says, go ahead, and I did. And it was probably one of the best things I'd ever done up till that time, because I felt so courageous. You know, I didn't get permission. It wasn't on the agenda. I found this poem by Maya Angelou in the process, you know, before I got there. And ever since then, I've been reciting this poem every chance I get. I mean, so much so that I forget that I didn't write it. I probably told somebody I wrote it once. I knew it. And I didn't mean to. But I love that poem because it does, it just speaks to it. Now, I want to talk about African-American women as activists, but this is not just about my sheroes. These are these stories, and I'll talk about should be women who should be considered as everyone's sheroes and heroes, and they are largely unknown. I'll talk about some that you've heard of, but this is also about how we have a tendency to take our sheroes and place them up there somewhere, so far away that we can't reach them. Now, we like to drag out their names, you know, who are they? I mean, name some, you know, the heroes and the sheroes, doesn't matter. And we like to drag out their names, and we like to put their pictures in front of children, and their stories in front of children, and we are insinuating, you should be like him or her. You should be like these people, because why else drag out the stories of sheroes and heroes if you didn't think that we would want to be like them? But, you know, I've been thinking about that, and I think that when we place them up there, we can't reach them. Their stories and their lives become so big that we feel that I could never be like that person. Never be like that person. That person is larger than life, bigger than me. They've done this, 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 and that. How could I compare? How could I, you know, it's blasphemous to think that I could be like that person. So I think that our heroes and sheroes have great stories that we all can learn from. And I think if we put them right here in front of us, right here where we can touch them, you know, that we'll start to understand that they are people just like we are, and that they began somewhere. And where they began is like everybody else, they were born. Everybody else. No matter if you began in slavery, you know, or in wealth, doesn't matter where you started, we all began at birth. Somebody gave birth to us. Somebody cared about us. That's part of the act. somebody nurtured us, somebody held our hand, somebody cleaned, you know, scraped the dirt off of our knees, somebody bathed us, somebody clothed us, somebody sent us to school, somebody hugged us, somebody cried with us, rejoiced with us, somebody had a vision for us, for our future, for our present, for the we that we could become. Somebody did that for us first, before we even knew anything about, you know, what shall I be when I grow up. Someone had a vision of that because they loved us. And I don't care if you started, like I said, with a silver spoon in your mouth, or if you started in slavery. Somebody loved you. And that's where I want to begin. Talking about African American women and activism, but I'm talking about the human spirit in all of us. I'm talking about those things, those sacred things that we can learn from those sheroes and heroes. Whether they're brown, black, green, or purple, we can learn, because we have more in common than we have different. So, this is where I'm going to start with our heroes, our sheroes, right here where we can understand them. How can I become like a Harriet Tubman if I don't know that she had parents who loved her, adored her? Did you know? Harriet Tubman was born 1821 in Dorchester County in Maryland. They had slaves in Maryland. Now, there's a picture that is painted in regards to slavery. And some of the worst stories that you've heard are true in some places. You know, there's 1,000 stories. And they all could be different depending on where you lived, who owned you. All of those kinds of things played into that, the norms of that particular slave society or that culture where, you know, was it north or was it south or was it way down deep south, you know? Was it if it was in New York or Missouri or, you know, all over the place there were slaves. So your situations, the things that you would have to experience, varied. Now, at this plantation where Harriet was born, on the day that she was born, there was a sub-community within the larger community on the plantation or on the farm. And this sub-community consisted of men and women, boys and girls who were enslaved. They didn't own themselves. Very few decisions could they make on their own. And of course they did. Every day that they awakened, every day that they opened their eyes, they had to make a decision. If I resist, how much will I resist? If I defy, what will be the consequences? Should I defy this much, or that much? Because each carried their own consequences. So I don't want to paint a picture that makes people believe that that people didn't have choices. You see those commonalities, no matter where we're born, who we're born from. We have some things in common, and that one thing that's really important is that we can all make a choice. But there is also something working within this sub-community where Harriet was born. There was a mother and a father. Her mother's name was Harriet. Her father's name was Ben. And their last name was Ross. Ben and Harriet Ross had several children before Harriet was born. She was the last of several children. And on the day that Harriet was born, they named her Araminta. Araminta. That was her birth name. They called her Minty for short. They called that a pet name, something we call a nickname. It was a pet name. They decided that they would wait and call her Harriet when she, you know, grew into some size. She would have to grow into that name. So Ben and Harriet Ross gave birth to Araminta. And in Harriet's own words, she was told that people from all over that little sub-community where the enslaved live. Because it took a long time for Harriet to be born. They waited all night long. But when she was born, they all came to visit. They all came to meet baby Harriet. To get to know Harriet. Something in common. Somebody loved her. A whole lot of somebodies loved Araminta. And they called her Minty. and they helped her grow. Now, between the ages of 0 or birth to 6 years old, children who were born in that condition were allowed to play. They were allowed to, you know, get into mischief. They were allowed to do this. They didn't have to do the work that their parents did. There was always an old granny or an old auntie who could no longer work in the fields or work in the house. And so these people were in charge of the children. You know, makes sense. But it is said, you know, that when a child would turn 6 years old, that is when that child would be taken and their training would begin at six. You know, we send children to kindergarten, preschool. They were, this thus began their training. You know, various kinds of things, ways that they would start training. Harriet was taken and rented out to another family at six. Can you imagine? 6 years old. 6 years old. She's going to leave this community. You know, the love that she's known, the protection, the safety that she's known, and they're taking her to another family in the same area, but it might as well be, you know, clear across the country, in another country. But they take her to this place, and they want her to help the missus clean house. This is the reason why they took her. It was gonna be her job to help clean house. Now, can you imagine a six-year-old child put a broom in her hand and told her to sweep? Put a cloth in her hand and told her to dust at six. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I remember myself, some of the things about myself at six, and that was not something that I wanted to do. That was not something that anybody would have wanted me to do. I remember my own kids at six. Please, no, you know, only for play. You know, and here's your little play broom. But get out of mommy's kitchen. But at 6 years old, is supposed to clean this house. And when she can't, you know, they just decided, oh, you're too lazy for that. So they decided to send her back home. And Harriet, oh, she is so happy about that. They send her back home. But one thing that her parents knows is that it won't be long before they find another place for her to go. So at seven, they rent her off to another family. And this particular woman, she was a seamstress, you know, she would weave. So she would have all this yarn, and that particular time, you know, Harriet had to stand like this so that she could wrap this, this yarn around her hands, you know. And, you know, she would have to stand there all day long and, you know, just be that, whatever that, what's that, the spool or something? And, you know, time went on during the day, and the particles from the yarn started to make her sneeze. So she got whipped for that. That was not something that they wanted her to do. So then they decided at 7 years old that Harriet should watch the baby. That makes sense. Have a seven-year-old child watch your baby. Now, here's what Harriet was supposed to do. Harriet was supposed to sit on the floor, cross-legged like this, and they'd place the baby in her lap. And Harriet was supposed to just rock the baby, just sit there and rock the baby all day long at seven. And you see, it's crucial that the baby does not cry, because if she does cry, then, you know, she's going to be whipped. She's going to be punished for that. So the object is to keep the baby quiet. Now, at night, Harriet would sit at the foot of the bed where the missus and the mistresses slept. And Harriet would sit there in front of the baby cradle, And they placed the cradle, the baby in the cradle, and they went to sleep, and Harriet's job was to rock the cradle all night long. Rock the cradle all night long. You know, and you know, there's something about that human spirit, though, isn't there? We have no idea, even in the worst times, why we're learning what we're learning. So Harriet learned to rock that cradle. And after, you know, a few times of being whipped because she fell asleep and the baby started crying, she learned to sleep with her eyes open. And she could almost rock that cradle in time in her sleep. You know, we just never know why we learn the skills that we learn. Now, when the mister and the mistress would go out for the evening and Harriet would be in charge, that's when she'd sleep. She'd let that baby cry all night and she slept. You know, so remember that skill that she learned that day. Well, here's what happened. One morning, Harriet is at the breakfast table with the mister and the mistress, and she's watching the baby. She's standing up. She can't sit with the family, so she's standing up. And the adults have their back turned. And Harriet, in her own words, said she saw a bowl of sugar cubes. She said, "I ain't never got nothing sweet." And I looked at that bowl of sugar cubes, and I looked at that bowl of sugar cubes, and something told me to reach for it. And when I did, somebody turned around and saw me. So what did the mistress do? She turned around and got the whip. Harriet, at 7, determined not to be whipped that day, ran around the table, out the door, and ran and ran and ran and ran and kept running. Now, the adults stopped running for her. They knew what Harriet didn't know. Harriet thought she could just keep running and she would run back to her mama. But the adults knew that 7-year-old's not going to run that far. She'll be back. But Harriet didn't know that, and she kept running and she kept running, and it got dark. And now, where am I going to sleep? She said. The only place she saw to sleep was a pig pen. Now, the pig pen, in her words, she said it was too tall for her to climb in, so she had to jump and tumble down in there with the pigs. Mm-hmm. And she said she stayed there from Friday to Tuesday, fighting with the pigs for something to eat. And then it got to be impossible. And her 7-year-old mind understood that, so what did she do? She climbed out somehow, and she went back to her punishment. Now she's considered a thief, lazy, and all those things, and so they send her back again. Now, the thing that her parents know is that she could be sold away. You know, happy to see her, but very afraid for her. So her mother tries to teach her a skill that she can use. Her mother doesn't want her out in the fields. She doesn't want her outdoors. She knows what kind of work that is. She thinks, I'll teach her to sew. I'll teach her to do, you know, to cook. And she would, but Harriet, that wasn't her thing. It wasn't her thing. And at 8 years old, she's still there. And at 9, she's still there, and her mother is still trying to keep her out of the fields. But Harriet thrives outdoors. And I think it has something to do with her being cooped up at 6 and 7. She knows what could happen inside of a house. She'd rather be outdoors. And this is what she did. She worked outdoors. She learned to work outdoors. You know, the skill of lifting things made her strong, made her quick, clever, and gave her freedom. Now, just like us. Harriet had a mother and a father. Now her father, Ben, was a most respected and trusted slave. Matter of fact, he was the boss in terms of those who cut down trees and made things, cleared the forest and made things. He was the boss. He could be counted on, trustworthy. The mother, Harriet, was very, very spiritual, and she's the one who, even though she couldn't read, had memorized whole Bible verses, you know. And she especially was fond of that story about Moses. You know, Moses had gone where? He'd gone to Egypt and freed the slaves. And the slaves during that time, I don't care where you lived at, knew that verse and held on to that verse, because if it could happen to them, it could happen to me. So anyway, these are the things that Harriet, older Harriet, taught younger Harriet, or Minty. Ben taught her things like this, because he was really smart. He'd take her into the woods, and he'd say, "Harriet, walk like this." Taught her to walk in the woods without making a sound. And then at night, he'd take her out there and he'd say, "Harriet," and he'd help her locate those stars. Told her what they were for, each one was for. And if you follow this and follow that, that particular star will take you north. Isn't it interesting how in our darkest hours, we could learn skills that will eventually save us and help free over 300 others? Harriet learned how to stand and sleep with her eyes open. Harriet learned how to walk quietly through the woods. She learned how to locate the North Star. So when she eventually freed herself, she was in her mid-20s. She had gotten married to John Tubman. Around this time, she had grown into that name, Harriet. And she got married, and they lived in a cabin on the plantation, but there was something about freedom that spoke to Harriet's spirit. She loved John Tubman, and John Tubman loved Harriet. But there was something about freedom that spoke to her spirit. So after she'd been married a few years, and even during that marriage, she talked to John Tubman about freedom. Now, John Tubman was a freed man. And she felt so fortunate because he married a slave, which meant now his movement is very limited. He has to stay there. If he wants to be with his wife, he has to live there. He's a free man, but now he's limited. So he loves Harriet. So we know that. And she talks to him about freedom. She says, "You know, let us go and be free. Let's run." And he says, "No. You know, we'll get caught, and you know, we could be killed, because they have seen, you know, the evidence of such. Slaves would run away and captured and brought back beaten or dead." And so he didn't want to go. And so Harriet would leave it alone. And then every once in a while, though, she had to talk about it. "John, let's go be free." Well, John reached the point where he didn't want to talk about it anymore. And at some point, he threatened to tell on her for talking about escaping if she continued to talk about it. So she stopped talking. But that doesn't mean she wasn't trying to be free. She thought about it, and a couple more years went by. and then found out that they were talking about selling her and two of her brothers to the deepest South, and that's where they did not want to be. So one day she woke up and decided that this was going to be the night that she would leave. Interesting to note, there were abolitionists in that area, and Harriet had met one. Don't know how close it was, you know, this meeting to the time when she actually left. You know, don't know if it was a week before, don't know if it was 2 years before, but Harriet remembered her name, remembered where she lived at, and decided there was only one thing that she could do. There was not, she only had one option. Somebody might could help her, maybe help her. And that was the only person she could think of. Now this is somebody who's white. Someone who could hurt her and not help her. But she decides that this is the woman she's gonna risk her life on. So she decides that this night I'm leaving. So Harriet, you know, did what she had to do to make it look like she was gonna be there, you know, for the rest of her life, you know, like every other day. And she woke up and she got thinking. Her parents worked out, you know, out there. And she knew that she was leaving this night. She decided that she would not want to leave and not be able to say goodbye. But she couldn't get to where they were at, you know, because, you know, everybody is accounted for. You know, you are here and they're here, and, you know, she may not see them until the next day or later that night. And there was no way she could get to them to say goodbye, to say, I'm leaving. So she decided that she would leave where she was working, the spot where she was working at, and she would go to the kitchen and tell the cook, you know, tell them that I love them, tell them that I had to go. And she started to do that, and on the way to the kitchen, she sees the master. He's on a horse, you know, traveling toward her. He doesn't quite see her, but what she does is she turns around and she thinks to herself, I'll sing a song. If I sing a song, a specific song, anyone who hears me, anyone out here working who hears my voice singing loudly, will tell my folks. I don't know where she is, but last time I saw her, she was walking that way and she was singing. They might say, what was she singing? And they would tell her, tell them. She sang, when that old chariot comes, friends, I'm going to leave you. I'm heading for the promised land. Farewell, oh farewell. Friends, I'm sorry I have to leave you. Farewell, oh farewell, but I'll meet you in the morning. Farewell, oh farewell, I will meet you in the morning on the other side of Jordan. Farewell, oh farewell, farewell, oh farewell. And at some point she made it back to her cabin, wait for nightfall. And while John was sleeping, she walked out. She just walked out. Now imagine her concern as she's going to this woman's house. Will she help me or will she hurt me? Will she save my life or end my life? You know, sometimes you just have to step out on what they call faith. And that's what she did. So she made it to this woman's house. She knocked on the door, scared. And the woman opened the door and Harriet standing there. And the woman brought her in. And that was her first stop on the Underground Railroad. Three or four other stops, you know, in barns, you know, in hay lofts. At one time she stayed with a family of freed blacks in a potato hole for a week. The last person, you know, who she met on that road took her to the river and told her to follow it north and she walked the equivalent of 90 miles. And she made it to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And Harriet said that when she stepped over the line to freedom, says she turned around and looked at everything. She said there was such a glow over everything that this must be heaven. And she wanted to know if she was the same Harriet free as she had been enslaved. Says she turned around and all she could do was hug herself and thank God. Just thank God. And she lived there in Philadelphia for about a year. But you know, there's something about being raised around people who love you. How are you going to be free without them? How? So she got it into her head, met all the men and the women, you know, who were the big abolitionists in Philadelphia, got to know them, started attending a lot of those meetings, finding out, you know, how this railroad works, and proposed to them that they allow her to go back and get her folks. And Harry, you're just an itty-bitty woman, and, you know, this takes, you know, and this takes, you'll never be able to do it, but Harriet was determined. There is something about the human spirit. When it's time for you to step into your purpose, you just do. You know, who knew? She didn't know. We don't know. We don't know. But you know, luckily there's somebody like Ben and Harriet Ross who will take the time to teach you the things that, you know, that they know. I can't teach you more than I know as a parent. But listen, this is what I know. Walk in the woods like this. And Harriet, remember the Bible verses, the ones that will sustain you. That's what I can teach you, said Ben and Harriet Ross. So when it was time for her to step into her purpose, she made that first trip back to Maryland. It took a year for her to work, save the money that she would need. Now, this railroad was intricate. You could get messages to folks. So the first time she made it back to Maryland, somebody knew somebody was coming. You know, maybe I'll sing a song like this. Maybe I'll make a sound like a bird like this. And it was all arranged. You meet me at this appointed spot. And if you're not there, I'll leave without you. So Harriet went back until over 300 folks had been brought out of slavery. Was she larger than life? You betcha. But there are times when we step into our purpose, when we know that we are too bigger than big. Am I right? We can't put Harriet up there. We gotta bring her down here. We gotta bring her down here. We can see her and feel her and know her. Because what good is her story unless we can identify with it? I will meet you in the morning on the other side of Jordan. Farewell, oh farewell, farewell, oh farewell. Time is up.
Well, I've been talking a long time.
Okay, I'm going to close. I'm not going to keep you much longer. But I wanted to say that I'm dedicating this session to my great aunt, Rosalie Clay Smith. Rosalie died, she passed away, left us on July 19th. She turned 86 on the 4th of July, and we have this big old neighborhood picnic for, party for her. She had been sick, just, you know, she for 85 years, Rosalie was, you know, she was 85, she's kind of stooped over, and she had aches and pains, but she was, you know, tip-top in terms of, you know, what she knew about life and what she wanted to do. I mean, she was, you know, she's still Rosalie, very wise and very capable, but she became ill about 6 months ago, and six, 7 months ago, and, you know, that's what happens. But anyway, I'm dedicating this particular session to her. When she passed away, I understood, you know, we just don't know. It's too bad we can't know everything when we're 20, 25, you know, that would make things so much easier. You know, not as interesting, I'm beginning to understand more and more, you know, that there are special people in our lives that we have to embrace while they're here. I don't know what that looks like, that embrace. I don't know what that looks like. You know, I just know that we have to figure out a way to do that. If it's to, you know, to be in their presence more often. If it's to take them to the store if they need to go. You know, take them out for, you know, something, so that when they pass away, you can say, I did that thing for my auntie, and she enjoyed it. It's so important, and it's not hard. It's not as hard as we think it is. So I'm going to close with this poem. I'm going to mention some of the women who were important to me. This is called An Unfinished Poem. It's an unfinished poem for the sheroes who helped me stand. Okay, and I say that it's unfinished because this ability to stand didn't start with them. Somebody gave it to them, you know. Somebody, and who, you know, who knows where it came from? So I call it unfinished, and hopefully this knack for standing will be passed on for generations. I did not create this poem, and it remains unfinished. It is merely my turn to say a few words for the legends in my life. For those whose large deeds were not recorded, this poem began with them. For the black sisters, mothers, aunts, cousins, and grandmas I watched keep on keeping on. Even while they sat, they were standing. Silent, they were teaching. Who even while putting a whooping on me were loving. This is for my mother, Barbara Holland Moore, whose legs were the stuff back in the day. Even now I see her strong legs walking, calf muscles tight, head high, backbone straight, shoulders square, pushing through the drama. Lately, I've noticed a little more definition in my calves, and it makes me wonder if I'm getting stronger, helps me understand just a bit of the meaning behind her struggle. This is an unfinished poem for the sheroes who helped me stand. For this woman, my mother, who stacked encyclopedias on the heads of my sister Beth and I when we thought it was just a game. She taught us to walk a little further without toppling from the weight. We used to giggle when she told us, now walk with your back straight, keep your shoulders square, and hold your head up. My great aunt Rosalie Clay Smith told me, we come from a family of musicians. There were seven children in her family. Harold played violin, Alan played trumpet, Francis still jams on the drums out there in California. Rosalie carries his picture with Muddy Waters. Lois was the singer. Flora couldn't sing, but she could whistle and make you see angels. My grandmother, Dorothy Clay Holland, played piano, as Rosalie still does at Wayman AME, where their mother, great-grandma Gracie Clay, was a traveling evangelist and respected mother of the church. Those sisters were movie star stunning at a time when, as now, Hollywood defined beautiful, and it was not us.
Today, Rosalie stands on her corner waiting for the children who do not cross the street without her. At age 74, wearing that orange vest, you will find her there every morning and every afternoon directing traffic. We ask her, Rosalie, when you gonna stop standing on that corner? And she laughs, but lets us know we need to mind our business. Recently, my aunt, cousin Julia Moore McCowan, showed me a photo of my great-great-grandmother, Eliza Wilson, taken years after she served this country in slavery. Years after she followed her husband, grandfather Charlie Wilson, from Kentucky, came north here where he served this country during the Civil War. In this picture, she feeds her own chickens in her yard, living in Port Byron, Illinois. They were the only black family in the town. When they arrived, my grandfather doctored animals while she helped one of the ladies keep and clean house. Grandma Eliza learned to stand, despite a system designed to break her back and her will. But she had to know the meaning of can't to can't. She had to believe that every goodbye ain't gone. Every goodbye ain't gone. I wonder, how many tears must be shed and swallowed? Yes, black women do cry. Before the salt takes on a life of its own. It helps you walk, backbone straight, shoulder square, head up. Who taught her to do that? I wonder, what did she used to sing? I think of the muscles and tendons, the blood flowing through her veins, my veins, looking from her photo to my daughters, who are just now getting their legs. And this poem must remain unfinished. Thank you. So picture of Grandma Eliza, picture of my mama and her legs. And I have CDs for sale. Let you know that. I'm leaving tomorrow.